welcome to Eye on the Middle East, a weekly podcast providing news and analysis on topics pertaining to the Middle East. I'm your host, Benjamin Gottlieb.
And I'm your co-host, Arzu Rezvani. Today we will be discussing Ehud Barak's departure from the Labour Party, the recent suicide attack in Tikrit, the collapse of the Lebanese government, and the Russian President Dmitry Medvedev's meeting with the Palestinian National Authority President Mahmoud Abbas.
Our expert guest today is Professor Lori Brand, who is an expert on the Middle East and North African affairs, and a professor of international relations at the University of Southern California.
The Eye on the Middle East cast can be found on iTunes and online at neontommy.com. So, Ben, a big week in the Middle East. Ehud Barak and four other members of the Israeli Labour Party have left the party and have formed their own coalition. Barak, who had been defense minister in the current government, will remain in that post. So, Ben, I got to ask, why is his departure so significant?
You know, Zua, I believe this is an incredibly significant event for Israel and Israeli politics. I think this really highlights the weakness of Netanyahu's coalition government and how ineffective they have been in bringing the Palestinians back to negotiations. In my opinion, it also highlights structural problems in the Knesset. Netanyahu was forced to form his government with Lieberman's ultra-conservative party, which effectively blocked the extension of moratoriums. Because of this and Netanyahu's vanity, in my opinion, he was unable to extend the moratorium in East Jerusalem. And, of course, that was during the U.S. brokered peace deals, and this is all come to nothing now.
So what does this mean for the Labour Party?
You know, I think this is the end of the Labour Party. I think they might still have a few seats in the Knesset, but essentially this is the end of their prominence. Barak's new independence party, the caucus is still out for whether or not this will have his party will have a significant impact in the Knesset. But barring unforeseen events in the upcoming elections, I believe this is the end of Labour. So Zhu, very unfortunate event. A suicide bomber detonated a vest of explosives on Tuesday in what was the worst single attack in Iraq in nearly 3 months. At least 49 people were killed. What do you make of the suicide blast?
Well, I think this calls into question the ability of the government to defend its own people. Prime Minister al-Maliki campaigned on the issue of providing defense for the Iraqi people. And anytime that breaks down, there is tremendous anger towards the government. In terms of responsibility, nobody has claimed credit, but it does appear that it was a well-organized attack.
And if we could take a step back, what does this really say about supposed progress being made in Iraq? And also, why are these attacks no longer big news?
Well, it doesn't say much about progress in Iraq. We haven't won over the hearts and minds of those in the region, from civilians to the military recruits. And not just with Iraq, but in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Although incidents of insurgency have decreased in Iraq over the course of the last year, attacks like this one suggest a real need for policy revision. So far, it seems that we've maximized the full potential of military engagement in Iraq, but something's missing. And I would argue that something is the better understanding of the Iraqi people and the culture they seek to preserve. All right, now moving on to one of Israel's neighbors, Lebanon. The Lebanese government collapsed last week after 11 ministers resigned in protest of the ruling party's support of the International Tribunal investigating the 2005 assassination of former Prime Minister Rafik Hariri. 10 of the ministers were from Hezbollah, which allied with nearly half the parliament. So what does this instability on the Lebanese front mean for that region?
Yes, today in the news, Saudi Arabia said that they had abandoned mediation efforts in Lebanon between the Shiite Hezbollah and Sunni leader Saad al-Harari over the killing of his father and warned that the country's future was at stake. This is a very dangerous time for the Arab world. A number of Arab countries, including Saudi Arabia, Syria, have all expressed that this could be a big threat to the region.
And what can we expect with the formation of a new government?
You know, it really depends on how this issue resolves. This could be the end of Lebanon's unity government. And from a security standpoint, it could be a major blow for the region, especially in Israel's interests. Russian President Dmitry Medvedev met on Tuesday with the president of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, in the West Bank oasis town of Jericho, and reaffirmed his country's support for a Palestinian state with its capital in East Jerusalem. What is the exact significance, in your opinion, of this visit?
Well, I think this visit serves two purposes. For one thing, leadership on both sides is wanting. Prime Minister Netanyahu does not have a lot of confidence from his people, and the same can be said for Mahmoud Abbas. It looks like it's an effort to push forward with the Israeli-Palestinian peace process after U.S. brokered talks stalled last year. But I also see this as Russia competing with the United States for influence in the Middle East, where it seeks to promote itself as a key power broker.
Yes, and what about Russia's interest in the region? What, if anything, do they hope to get out of these meetings? And do you think they're making a significant statement by including East Jerusalem as a capital of the new Palestinian state in their requests and demands?
Well, according to state-run Russian news agency RIA Novosti, Russia is promising economic assistance and will grant some $30 million in humanitarian aid to the Palestinian Authority. At the same time, you have to look at this in terms of state interest. What is the economic interest in the region? What's the political interest? And it looks like among the talks are subjects including bilateral economic projects and energy cooperation and arms sales. So,
Zoo, is this an effort, is this an action by the Russians to kind of stir things up and assert themselves in the Middle East?
Possibly. I think so. The Middle East right now is very vulnerable with things that you're seeing in Lebanon right now and the stalled talks between the Arabs and Israelis. I think Russia's swooping in to make a statement.
Okay, well, we want to take a quick break to remind you that you are listening to Eye on the Middle East. This is a weekly podcast. I'm your host, Benjamin Gottlieb.
And I am your co-host, Arzu Rezvani. Dr. Lori Brand joins us in the next segment on the ongoing turmoil in Tunisia. Professor Lori A. Brand is the Robert Granford Wright Professor and Professor of International Relations at the University of Southern California. She holds a Bachelor's of Science in French from Georgetown University and a Master's of International Affairs and PhD from Columbia University. A four-time Fulbright Scholar to the Middle East and North Africa, her areas of expertise include emigration and diaspora and the role of Arab nationalism and Islam in the construction of post-independence national narratives.
Professor Brand, welcome and thank you for joining us here.
Thanks a lot. It's nice to be with you, Ben.
The recent revolution, so to speak, in Tunisia has made big headlines this week in the news. Can you talk a little bit about the events leading up to the Tunisian protests and what has sparked the current unrest?
Well, the most immediate spark, I think, has been pointed to by a number of commentators, and that was, there was a series of demonstrations, but there was a young man who was a university graduate but had been unable, like many of his fellow Tunisians with university degrees, to find a job that was commensurate with his skills and had therefore, in order to support his family, had to resort to selling fruits and vegetables. He was doing so and was stopped by a police officer who requested to see his permit for selling vegetables, something that he didn't have. Anyway, he didn't have this permission, and apparently his cart was overturned. And it was a sort of the culmination of years for him and certainly many of his compatriots of a real a frustration, an anger, and a humiliation. And I think we really can't underestimate the humiliation aspect of it.
How would you characterize the protesters themselves? I mean, are these middle class, educated people? I mean, how are these people characterized?
Well, I think there are different components of the protests. A large number are clearly the young, and many of them would be certainly high school graduates, many of them university graduates, and probably many of them, like the young man who killed him, who set himself on fire and ultimately died, probably underemployed or unemployed. But there also were clearly, if one watches the various reports, either on TV post on YouTube, Facebook, and so on, there are clearly there's an important representation of the middle class, of sort of middle-aged folks who would have been professionals, teachers, lawyers. In fact, the lawyers themselves as a syndicate, as a union, went out in support of protests. So you have a whole range of people who were involved in these protests.
So what role, if any, has the web played in the unrest?
Well, I think it's been, and I've been following the events really closely on Facebook and on Twitter, and then also sort of been glued to Al Jazeera for long hours at a time. I think it has enabled, and this was a point that was made by a woman who was interviewed on Al Jazeera the other day, it's enabled many of us who are far away to feel like we almost have front row seats on what's been happening. It's also, I think, enabled other Tunisians to get a better sense of what was happening in different parts of the country, which have been very, very difficult in the past, given the extremely restrictive nature. I mean, Tunisian, the state media were the only ones that were allowed to operate, and they didn't report anything like this over the years. So that when there had been demonstrations in the past, people learned about them through through word of mouth. They would have been careful because they would have been concerned about state harassment and so on. So it's given people a new source of information. It also enabled people to, as we saw in the case of demonstrations in Iran after the last elections, enable people to warn others where there were particular confrontations, also to tell people where there were going to be new demonstrations. So it was a form of a very important communication, I think. But some people, I think, have gone too far in looking at the impact of new media and have said that, sort of called this a Twitter revolution, which I think is kind of silly, actually. I wouldn't want to downplay the importance of the information that was available and that it enabled people to know what was going on and to help them better defend themselves, particularly after Ben Ali left and it was clear that his security forces, including elements of the police who are supposed to be defending citizens, were in fact participating in looting and various forms of destruction of property, it let people know that there were local defense groups that were being established in various neighborhoods to take care of, to protect people's property. So the informational aspect was extremely important, but it didn't cause it. It did not cause this revolution. This was something which was the forces behind which had been building, and the spark of the suicide of this young man sort of set things off.
Now, you mentioned the 2009 Iranian unrest, and the events that we see now in Tunisia are very reminiscent of what went on in June 2009. How comparable are they, would you say?
Well, I think they're extremely different, frankly. What you had in the case of Tunisia was a relatively homogeneous population that, in terms of demonstrations, was overwhelmingly in support of throwing out the government. You didn't have counter demonstrations in Tunisia. You haven't had, and you're not going to have counter demonstrations in Tunisia as you had in Iran, where after the anti-government demonstrations or oppositional demonstrations, you then had thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people, also flocking to various cities or from various cities who were demonstrating in support of Ahmadinejad, for example. So I think that's a big difference. The other big difference in the Tunisian case, and in fact, I was just reading a report on Al Jazeera this morning, which indicates that the reason Ben Ali decided to leave when he did was precisely because the general whom he had ordered to fire on demonstrators had rejected that order. Uh-huh. And so in order for any significant revolt or certainly a revolution to succeed, and we don't know how far this is going, but at least in the initial stages, right, you have to have a defection of a significant part of the security forces. You have to have some kind of major force, whether it's the army, the police, say, we will not fire on our fellow citizens. And that did happen in the case of Tunisia. And in fact, the army came in. The army is a relatively respected force in Tunisia. And in fact, it protected citizens against members of the presidential guard and against some of the members of the security forces and sort of marauding militias who were part of the previous regime. We really didn't have that in Iran at all until you have a major, which you did have in 1979, of course, right? So there's a parallel there, but not in the more recent Iranian demonstrations.
Dr. Brand, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
This is Eye on the Middle East, broadcast live from the basement of the USC Annenberg Graduate School of Journalism. Please subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Just search for Neon Tommy, Eye on the Middle East. Thank you so much. Stay tuned for next week's podcast, and take care.
Thank you.